5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is Durant, and welcome to Positive the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, Diara, and Don Calloway is joining us for the news this week. Kai is not with us, but if you see Kai on the internet, or if you happen to see her in person, say happy birthday. It was just her birthday, and Kai is amazing. And you're actually listening to this episode on my birthday, Tuesday, July 9th. So it's cool to be a year older, and it's cool to be in the same birthday space as Kai. Here we go. We talk about all things going on with the campaign for president, Lord, and then we talk about some news that you don't know. Here we go. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Deray, at D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
Milesy Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And you can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
Don Calloway, Instagram, at D Calloway, and at the Caucus Room.
We got Don Calloway joining us today. Kai cannot be here. It was Kaya's birthday, so if happy you birthday. See Kai on socials, make sure you say happy birthday to Kaya. Woo, 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 woo. So there's a conversation that has been continuing for the past, week and a half, 2 weeks, it feels like, and that is about Joe Biden. Should he be the nominee? Do we talk about the debate forever? The interview he tried to do, or he did do, did that help him? Did it hurt him? Can somebody else be the nominee in time? Are they putting Kamala in a corner? Do they need to bring her out? So I wanted to just like bring that back up because it has been in the news and people have been talking about it.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of things. Obviously, everyone has said all of the things about the debate and everyone has said all of the things and all the hot takes about, well, the real person who should be dropping out is Trump. Yeah, we get all of that, right? So bottom line, can Biden beat Trump? We're getting to a crucial juncture. And, you know, as an old player once told me, if it's inevitable, do it now. So I need Democratic leadership to make a decision between whether or not Joe Biden can win or he can't. And if he cannot win, it's time to move him out now, right? Obviously, we love Uncle Joe. No disrespect to him. That's the thing. Let's just make a decision. And it's an important distinction we have to make that the Biden camp, right, his family and the three or four guys who he keeps around them, Ron Klain and a few other guys, the Biden camp is not the Democratic Party. So there's a few different distinct camps here at play. And the Biden camp is the one saying, yes, go, Unc. We love you. Believe in you. Go get him, Dad. The Democratic Party are the folks who are going to have to make a grown-up decision here. I am just seriously imploring them to get it done within this week. And, you know, I wouldn't be heartbroken if they make a decision that Joe Biden is our candidate and we're going to run on Joe Biden and we're going to run against Trump. But we need to make a call. And I feel like we need to make a call now. Now, if we make that call and if the call is to move beyond Joe Biden, there is no reasonable universe under which the nominee should be anyone other than Kamala Harris. I don't understand procedurally how that could happen. I don't understand legally how that could happen as a function of fundraising and financing a campaign. The practicalities not only suggest that it should be Vice President Harris, but the realities of, you know, the racism and sexism and all of that in this country suggests that it should be Kamala Harris. Who else are you looking to at this point? Who else is more qualified if you consider the holistic duties of the president? So anybody out there this week who's telling you Joe Biden needs to move on and wants to engage in some type of liberal Hunger Games to pick a nominee over the next 6 weeks, that is an exercise in futility. It's also an exercise in extraordinary racism and sexism. If we're going to move on, let's get the vice president ready. And some part of me feels like that might be happening now behind the scenes over the last 2 weeks. She's been very quiet, and I think she's savvy and knows what she's doing is something other than her just being respectful of the president, right? She knows what she's doing, and something tells me that she's gearing up for an imminent decision. I just hope that decision is made sooner rather than later, because the bigger picture here, whether it's President Biden, Vice President Harris, or anybody else, the bigger picture here is defeating Donald Trump and defeating Project 2025, at least for another 4 years.
And wait, you feel like Kamala Harris is gearing up for an imminent decision?
I think she might be, yeah. Okay. And she should be, right? I mean, if we have to move past Biden, she is in the catbird seat there. I certainly think that she is and should be gearing up for that. I don't have any inside information, but I get some sense around D.C. that that's partially what's happening.
You don't got no inside information. After you say you get a sense around D.C., that sounds like insider information. But
like Benny Siegel.
I agree. Obviously, I think that like Kamala is like the choice. I do understand. I feel like I said this last week, too. I feel like I do understand the anxiety around nominating Kamala, because that might alienate the very people they were trying to seduce with putting Biden as president. So because she's Black, because she's a woman, because they might feel like, oh, we're going to have another, you know, 4 years of like, you know, neoliberal Obama gates open, rainbow flags everywhere. I understand the anxiety around putting her in, even though I think that she is obviously the best person to put in, but that also might alienate just a slew of Americans who just have a bad taste in their mouth about progress. But, you know, I don't think kneeling to them is ever okay, but specifically not now.
Actually, I read over the week in the New York Times, there was this piece on Clyburn and how Clyburn had mentioned a mini primary and how he wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily. And I think, Don, to your point, the issue is like legally what happens in terms of campaign finance laws, da 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 da. Kamala, I think, is the only one that the zillions of dollars that the Biden campaign has raised, Biden-Harris campaign has raised, Kamala then would be able to put to work. So I think that is one of the key factors in all of this, is actually like how to leverage all of those hundreds of millions of dollars that have been raised. Miles, I think to your point, you know, what I was thinking about this weekend is like, is it just that we have a lack of imagination, like the American people, just given what we've been through? Because I think this conversation around like, it can only be Joe Biden, and is kind of a wild conversation. And Don, we talked about this last week, and Miles was like, anybody can be famous overnight. This is America. So like the whole name recognition thing, the people don't like that really, it's a factor, but not really. And I think folks' appetites to be excited, and even looking around the world and like what's happening in France and like how, you know, how the left is really organizing and getting excited, like, I think there is sort of a zeitgeist that we could play into, but because we are so unimaginative in this country, it's like gotta be this white guy. So I don't know, just what's been going through my mind the last few weeks.
You know, I think I've been surprised actually at, I know I said this before in another episode, but I've been surprised at the lack of surrogates on the campaign who can just tell a coherent story about much of anything. Because the story they're even telling about Joe in the performances, and the story that frankly that he's telling, is not comforting. You know, in the interview, he's sort of like, I'm gonna do my best. And you're like, well, that, you're like, nah, I don't really know if that's the best story. Or people being like, you know, I think it actually is fair to be like, I've been a great president. One debate doesn't define my president. Like, I think that is a fine story to tell, but y'all gotta start saying some other stuff. And the Project 2025, attacks have actually, I do think, have been helpful. And they, to me, feel like a silver lining. And like a silver lining in terms of we can get people on our side because it is just so wild. But I, over the weekend, I spent a lot of time trying to find like a really good succinct explainer about Project 2025. And I couldn't. I saw a lot of Instagram posts, but like, you know, I was talking to somebody about it. I was at a wedding in Jamaica and we were talking politics and, you know, the Instagram posts are like, they want to get rid of the FDA and da, da, da. That only matters if you understand that their whole idea of deregulation is that businesses should set the rules for themselves. But if you don't understand that the whole premise is that businesses should set their own rules and not anybody else like the government, then you don't really get why the end of the FDA matters. That would be every company becomes Boeing. Don't nobody want that? Like when you say it like that, people are like, nobody wants that. But when you say, my father don't care about the FDA, he has no emotional connection to the FDA. But if you tell him the companies are like Boeing, he's like, oh no, we not vote for that. You know what I mean? And that is storytelling. And I have just been continually shocked, but I don't know about, you know, I'm sort of left out of the nominee fight. I'm like, y'all just pick somebody so we can figure it out. But I will say, I cannot believe it's this hard to fight Trump. I mean, the man is, it's really crazy that it's this hard up against somebody who is just so wild.
Yeah, that's one thing about Trump, evil and horrific as he is and everything he stands for. He is an A-plus political talent because he understands the nature of how Americans think. And fundamentally, he understands that it ain't that deep, right? I think that everybody on this screen and the folks who are going to be listening to, we think far more about this than most people do. The only reason that people are paying attention right now is because they're looking to see if it's going to be a dim swap summer. But the reality is that most Americans, and this might be a uniquely American thing to your point, Diarra, when you see the leftist gains in England and in France, the reality is that most Americans right now are tripping off whether Bronny got drafted and he shouldn't have, and the other half are watching Dancing with the Stars. And so I think Trump understands that. That's why he knows he can lie. That's why he knows he can just, you know, BS his way through this thing. And he's done it for 10 years while the MSNBC folks like myself, you know, are talking about the constitutional and philosophical realities of why he's such an abhorrent person. Well, my neighbor who's educated and, you know, a taxpaying citizen doesn't give a blank about that. Right. And you got a whole lot of folks running around talking about, well, who I'm going to pay more taxes under, or, well, Kamala them, they for them folk. People aren't thinking about this as much as we are. And that's why it is important to say, hey, you don't want Boeing because you don't want the doors flying off your airplane, right? We have to simplify, but a lot of times that's anathema to educated liberals. The problem is that educated liberals are going to be the same folks telling you this week not to put up that black woman as our nominee because she, quote unquote, can't win, right? And so it's the Malcolm thing we have to pay attention to, you know, the white liberal, because I don't think that's going to be a camp who is necessarily for progress and liberation in the way they talk about politics over the next 3 months. They might get on board at the very end when it's time to make that final push to punch Donald Trump in the face, metaphorically, of course, but I don't see them as being very helpful throughout this process.
I just had a quick question. Do you think, or for everybody, anybody who has an answer, do you think that part of the fear is also Kamala Harris as a nominee would actually animate more people who are Trumpers, because then it would be like more of like a cultural like war of a vote, if that makes sense. Like it would be Trump, white older man, versus Kamala, black liberal woman. Is that like part of the fear that we need somebody who's a white man so we don't create this cultural war as a vote and actually animate some of who Trump's base are and people who feel certain ways?
I think it's my perspective that the Democratic Party always is trying to figure out how do they get moderate folks? How do they get middle of the road folks? And so they tend to pick candidates that speak to that. Don, I agree with you somewhat, but I feel like it's a matter of like of degree of how much folks are paying attention, right? Like, no, like I'm watching MSNBC every day too, because Powell's on, so we got to watch all day long. Like, I think there are us that are constantly watching and in it. But I do think there are people that are deeply concerned. And while, you know, my mom is watching Country Wayne all day long, she also very much cares about what her vote is going to do. Terrence Woodbury, he was on talking to somebody, and I reposted what Terrence said, because Terrence basically said that, and Terrence, if I get this wrong, you know where I live, that, you know, there's this whole sort of notion or sort of like narrative around excitement when it comes to these elections, particularly for Black folks. Like, and he was like, that's just not necessarily a thing. It's just like voting is something that Black people do. So there doesn't have to necessarily be this like intense spirit around it, right? So I feel like that's how we think about like voter enthusiasm. It's like this sort of made up thing that has so many stereotypes attached to it. And part of why it sort of has to be like manufactured is because they constantly pick nominees that don't really speak to us. And then there's an issue with our enthusiasm. It's like, how can we be enthusiastic about this dude? I mean, obviously he's done all these things, historic legislation, da 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 da. But like for a first time voter, Joe Biden is 65 years older than a first time voter, basically, which is wild. Yeah. Like you're a whole older person older than a first time voter.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
And I do think, you know, I was looking through Project 2025 and, you know, it's like, it is going to be a nationwide ban on pornography, for instance. I know if a certain segment of the country knew that, they'd be like, oh yeah, we not voting for that. You know what I mean? But it's like when, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at the messaging the left is putting out. They're doing all this stuff about abortion and Medicare. 90% of people who are not on Medicare don't know what Medicare is. And abortion is an issue we can win on. It's just not the only issue we should be talking about. Like, it is one of them for sure. But I look up and I'm like, y'all, this can't be, you know, Project 2025 is going to end all federal funding for transportation. Like, public transit, that is crazy. You know, like people would be animated by these issues. And to your question, Miles, I'm not, you know, the reality is I don't think Kamala's going to lose anymore. Like, the people that hate Kamala and are racist already hate her. They already hate her. They're not going to vote for her.
That's right.
The people that are sexist already hate her. You know, like, we're not going to lose anybody. But I do think she could help animate people. The hard thing about Kamala that I do think is hard is that Kamala has been hiding in a corner for 4 years and has been smiling at us, being like, you know, it's been, hello, my name is Kamala Harris. Like, the person of Kamala Harris, where does she go? We missed it. Like, it is, it feels a little weird. And I think the person could win. I don't know. I feel like they are so worried about her being the angry Black woman that we aren't even getting a full person anymore. And I remember meeting Kamala. I remember Kamala, Senate Judiciary Kamala. Where'd she go?
You know, the thing about the vice president is that if you think that this presidency has been an extraordinarily successful administration, and it has from a legislative substantive perspective, then she has every right to append herself to that story as, I was a part of this. I was at the table. I helped push this through the Senate. I helped push this through the House. Frankly, that's why Joe is here, because we believe that he sat at the right hand of our Lord and Savior Barack Obama for 8 years. She has the right to append herself to that success in the same way that he has appended himself to the Obama aura, right?
That's right. So
in that respect, whether or not, you know, the DeRays of the world who sit at the tables of criminal justice thought reform, whether or not you felt like she was active, and whether the liberal thinkerati thinks like she was active, she has the right to tell the American people that she was there and she was part of these successes, right?
Just to be clear, that's not my critique. My critique
is not. I know you're not saying.
I'm just saying, where'd the person go? We are missing there's a part of the personhood of her that I feel like got tamped down during this administration.
Well, you know, two brothers back in the 1800s, you know, were identical twins, and one went off to sea and the other became vice president. Neither were ever heard from again. So historically, there is no mega role for the vice president until it's time for them to run for president. I don't know what Al Gore did for 8 years during the Clinton presidency, right? Maybe because I was a kid, or maybe because he ain't do nothing. So if you think the Biden administration was successful, then she has a story to tell.
That's right.
And she can tell it with her Kamala spice on it about where she was and what she was doing for the last 4 years to assist in this success. The problem with the Democratic Party, I was talking to my partner, our mutual friend, DeRay Jared Lowell. If you have worked in Democratic politics for any appreciable time, I'm young, but I've got 25 years in. You have seen the biannual race to find square-jawed, mediocre white boys and trot them out. And you have worked as a brilliant African-American behind these people who are extraordinarily mediocre. But we see this not only at the presidential level, but at the school board level. We see this annual homage we make to find these basic white folk. And it's going to really sicken my stomach to see it played out on the presidential level, particularly when it means skipping over the actual sitting vice president.
Whatever version of Kamala, I think she will be more exciting than what we are working with. Joe Biden was in Philadelphia over the weekend, and he was with, raise your hand if you know these people. To your point, Dre, around surrogates, he was there with Lieutenant Governor Austin Davis. We know Senator John Fetterman, Senator Rep Malcolm Kenyatta, and I love Malcolm. He was with Josh Shapiro, who's the governor. He was with Representative Brendan Boyle, also love Brendan, but like, what? Madeline Dean, Mayor Sherelle Parker, and Wanda. Who? The fact that that was probably like a celebrated campaign event in Philadelphia for a re-election campaign that we are desperate to win. Like, we got to turn up the heat, and we're not going to do it like this. We're not.
And the last thing I'll say before, because I know you have news that is around this too, DR, is I also think we got to explain the why to the surrogates, because I have seen some surrogates just tell people, like, I think about the deregulation thing has been what I've been on. And they're like, they try to get rid of the FDA and da da da. And the surrogate can't tell me they can't explain why deregulation is a bad thing. They have no clue. They're just like literally repeating a talking point. And you're like, no, you got to explain, like, the moment of like, you just say things and people are like, da da da, or like, we could call things racist and that actually meant something. Those days are gone. We got to like really help people understand it and explain it. And the campaign has to do that too. I think about, like, I know, you know, people feel a way about Charlemagne and the shade room and da da da. But what's clear to me when I watch all these political people get on there is that nobody sat down and talked to them to build their capacity. Like, they just are asking questions. Nobody explained any of the stuff to them. And you're like, guys, we should be winning. It should not be this hard to fight this crazy man.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
DR, take us.
So I've been spiraling for many days, just reading everything I can about this here election. And sort of all where I really love to spiral is just around like Biden's, just like the president's competencies. And so I came across this story about this reporter, Andrea Lawful Sanders. What a great name. But she essentially did an interview, Joe Biden. It was during this whole sort of like feast of getting him out there in Pennsylvania over the weekend. And the headline is that it's for the New York Times, it's radio host who was fed questions by Biden campaign leaves Philadelphia station. So I'm like, this is interesting. Like, what? And so as I'm reading deeper, I find out, one, it's a Black radio station, WURD. Then I find out that, and you know, then I'm like, okay, well, Andrew obviously must be a Black reporter. And I think I started to, I guess I'm trying to figure out the right questions to ask around this, right? I don't really have questions that lead to answers necessarily, but my questions are, one, why does a Black woman always take the fall? Number two, why was she chosen for this interview? And additionally to that, in that same line of questioning, why does it seem that the Biden campaign only goes to reporters that they know they will be infinitely supported by, right? And I think this was my issue with the George Stephanopoulos. I still can't say this man's name, George Stephanopoulos. There we go. But that interview I watched as a part of my spiral, he pushed him, but not really. Right. And so here we are seeing the campaign giving questions to this woman. And I bet you the conversation was, well, the only way y'all are going to get this interview is if you ask these set of questions. Again, I'm hoping my colleagues here have better thoughtfulness around this than I do. But I think this one's one I'm just like sort of stuck on.
You know, I don't think it's criminal for a high level campaign to seek out friendly media outlets.
100%.
We are moving into a moment, however, where much of our media is critique of media. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder whether or not arranged media will be able to stand that level of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. The irony here is that had the questions not been prearranged and effectively softballs, he still would have got softballs. A good working sister at a local radio station
exactly.
is not here to Sean Hannity, the president of the United States. It would have been a cakewalk for him regardless. So why do the prearranged cabal looking thing, which blows this all out of proportion? The reality of this is to me that without the debate performance, or frankly, without him maybe being old and slowing down a bit, Biden walks into that interview with very little prearrangement and gives it his best and everything is fine. And we still don't know this woman's name. And more importantly, she still has a job. And so what I'm seeing is a whole lot of, you know, voodoo and obfuscation from the Biden camp to make him look his best because they know that he's probably not at his best, or there's a potential that he might not be at his best without this prearranged concoction of an interview. And even for those of us on the political left, that tends to inject a little bit of doubt and a little bit of the slightest amount of hateration in this dancery in such a way that it challenges us for whether or not this is the guy throughout the end of the year. Because I could take DeRay and have given him that interview on criminal justice reform and no prep needed, right? And same for you, De'Ara, on your area of expertise, and same for Miles. And so when we're seeing the Biden camp tie itself into knots, it creates what's known generally as an unforced error. And now we're talking about this instead of talking about Project 2025, talking about how to defeat Donald Trump. And it's another, I hate to say this word, but I'm being lazy. It's another chink in that armor that it makes you wonder if this is really the guy and if this is really the candidate we need for the moment.
I do think what the right has been really good at that has been brutal is holding, like forcing these standards on the left while they are running propaganda machines. It's like, yes, right-wing radio is not only are they prearranging the questions, but it is all a setup. Fox News is all, it is just 100% of a setup. You're like, well, this is crazy that they are even, you know, even Trump distancing himself from Project 2025 on Truth Social or whatever the other Twitter alternative thing is that the right wing runs while all his people are pushing Project 2020. You're like, y'all are just straight up lying to our faces and got us over here talking about this radio host who, like you said, Don, the questions were going to be rather chill no matter what they asked him because it's a local radio. Like, we never heard of her before. You know, like, yeah.
I just didn't understand the loss of the job. I didn't. And
wild.
So how I'm seeing it, and I'm so open to being wrong, I my brain went straight to, like, power dynamics for whatever reason, and I just didn't understand how we can see the power dynamics of a president coming to a local reporter in what the results would be because of that and the influence that would happen. I didn't understand how she is at fault for lack of better words, like bending to the will of like the most powerful person in administration in the world. Like what? Like I that's still confusing and fogging to me how they resulted in you need to lose your job, and yeah, I'm hoping for some grown up clarity on that.
Now, I do think that she should have asked some original questions, but there is not a press team I know that does not send questions to them. Like, that is what the press people do. I think on my book tour, I didn't know this. So my book comes out in 17 or something like that, 16, 17. And I'm on the tour and people keep asking the same question. I'm like, how are all these people asking me the exact same question? And I realized the publishers have sent questions to all the moderators in advance, so that they could like hit these themes and topics. And they didn't all ask all of the same questions, but there were a couple questions that everybody, I was like, wow, everybody has the same question. And I'm like, no, the press people sent the questions in advance. That makes sense.
Yeah, but this goes, and this is only because my father-in-law has interviewed multiple presidential candidates. There is a very strategic thought process behind what reporters are going to interview these folks, how, to Don's point, how friendly these folks are. And yes, there's a conversation around what the questions look like, but there's a very deliberateness strategically in terms of who gets the interview and who's doing the interview. Like there's a reason why for Univision, Enrique, I think his last name's Acevedo. I don't know. Ugh. That Enrique gets, remember that big Latino journalist that interviewed Trump and he asked all these softball questions. He was chosen on purpose. You know what I mean? Anyway. So I hear what you're saying, Dre, but I do feel like this is one of those things where I guess it takes me to a heart place, because I feel like with Hillary, I was never fearful about putting Hillary in rooms to answer questions. Actually, it was quite the opposite. Like, she was so capable and so thoughtful. And we had such in-depth conversations around so many issues that she wanted to understand, wanted to be prepared, wanted to understand what the pivot was. And so I guess what's troubling to me is like, I really want somebody that is so smart and so dynamic to have the most important job in the world. I don't know. Maybe that would be nice, but anywho, who's next?
So my news is about kidney transfers. This is switching topics. We talked about kidneys before at some point, because I remember it was a health topic we talked about, but I'll repeat this part, is that Black people, you know, are only 12-13% of the population, but you might not have known that Black people account for 35% of those with kidney failure. And the reason is the combination of diabetes and high blood pressure, which are two of the largest contributors to kidney disease, which are overrepresented in the Black community. And about 100,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for a kidney at any given time. And as you can imagine, Black people are more likely to need transplants and less likely to receive them. That is not my news. My news is that I did not know that there is a system of rating the viability of a kidney that includes the race of the kidney donor. And the way that it codes the race of the kidney donor is that it assumes that kidneys from Black donors are more likely to stop working after a transplant than kidneys from donors from other races. So what happens is that kidneys donated by Black people are literally thrown away, are discarded at higher rates because of the algorithm, which downgrades the quality based on the donor's race. And that blew my mind. And what, you know, I was reading about it, and what they believe is that it actually might be a genetic variation and not a race difference that is what is happening with the viability of a kidney. And we've seen, you know, I'm relatively new to this, but in the past 5 years, I learned so much about how race was included in so many medical calculations across a host of things. I just didn't know that at all. And I was shocked to even think that we were throwing kidneys away because of just a plug and play algorithm. And as you can imagine, Black people are more likely to get a kidney from Black people. So not only are we throwing kidneys away, but we are seriously disadvantaging the overrepresented group of Black people in the population who need kidneys because they're not getting kidneys. And I was like, you know what? You know, it reminded that when we say everything's about race, we are right. And this has not been corrected yet. And I'm happy that people are paying attention to it because it legitimately blew my mind. So I wanted to bring it here.
If I make it my business to get cut open and give y'all a kidney, keep that. Do not make me find out that you threw it away. This article blew my mind. I think mostly because we always kind of like return to this, like these like medical institution conversations. And I feel like every single time we bring something on, it gets a little bit more ridiculous than the last time that we've heard it. And to me, this feels like the top most ridiculous thing. And anytime we have these conversations, I always feel like I always end up like saying something that kind of gives way to this Black radical fantasy. But I do think that we need our own hospitals and medical institutions. I think there's been such a case on this podcast alone through articles of how us Black folks having our own medical institutions and really prioritizing that is really, 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 really important. And it is not just, you know, sometimes when you talk to people who are on the left or radical, sometimes when you want them to go into what do we do, they'll say these like nebulous things like we need our own institutions and we just need to start those things. And I'm always like critical of those answers. But when it comes to medical stuff and health stuff, I'm totally sold on that, because this article is wild. It's just wild to me, and I don't know any other solution, because it just seems as though this is so baked into the medical institution that it's not going to be reversed. And if it is reversed, it's not going to be fast or easy. So there needs to be a pivot, because kidneys are needed now, and they're being thrown away. They're being thrown away. There should be a Black kidney freezer.
Miles,
they can keep it at my house.
Okay. Dr. got the room. I've been to her apartment.
You know what this makes me think of, which I'm really about to take everybody down, is that I'm in a friend group. There's five of us. And all of our dads have passed away. Our moms are thriving, but our Black dads are gone. My dad, who we call Smooth because he never seemed to be bothered, but practiced criminal law in DC, Maryland for 40 years. Stephanie's dad, who fought in Vietnam. Crochet's dad, who was one of the first Black men to integrate local politics in West Palm Beach. Kendra's dad, who was a Black man and an accountant in a very white space for all of his professional life, basically. And I say all this because even these men who were privileged, had access to healthcare, had loving families, they died. And my hypothesis is they died because of racism in this country. And so I think when I see stories like this, it just is a reminder of how real it is for us from a health perspective, because we're losing our family members, or human beings. And at times it feels like there's nothing we can do about it. So I think this is where this story took me, because to Miles's point, it is a system that is dehumanizing us, and it has real outcomes for who we are as a people that I think go unnoticed and untalked about in sort of like a collective movement type of way.
Yeah, the great Damon Young has a book called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. And it is effectively based on that same, you know, that same premise that you just put out there, Diarra, about the five ancestors that were your fathers. Yeah, I mean, life causes cancer. Blackness causes metastatic cancer. That's just what it is. And I think, listen, I'm no endocrinologist, but I can tell you that that is often found. The stress of daily blackness often manifests itself in renal failure. And that's why I'm not surprised at all to see this being the specific location of racial disparity in not only medicine, but business. Medicine is business. Racism is baked into business. Therefore, racism is absolutely baked into medicine. And there is no business at this point, whether it is you or I deciding how much to post every day on social media to maximize exposure and likes and therefore product sales, or a farmer watering crops. There is no business at this point in 2024 which is succeeding without baking in algorithms and thought and predictive modeling. We saw the NFL a few years ago was sued because its CTE payouts. They finally acknowledge that CTE brain damage is happening as an inherent result of playing football. But baked into the financial payouts to these players was that Black players have a lower cognitive ability baseline to begin with. Therefore, as a result, they didn't have that much to lose by getting banged in the head. Therefore, we can write them smaller checks. Whoa. So this is the regularity of the business of medicine. You have to remember that the doctors who are now applying research analytics, well, their granddaddies believed in phrenology, right? Mm-hmm. Their granddaddies believed in all of the Black women don't feel pain, uterine experiments. So this is baked into the history of medicine. And I imagine that once every 18 months, we will see the New York Times or Washington Post article that bears out some investigative reporter's work, but is really bearing out what we have always known at the Black hospitals and Black doctors and Black care practitioners. And I think it's one of those things like Michael Herriot says, oh, now it's a thing because y'all saying it, or now it's a thing because one of y'all believe it. But yes, I am all for the Black Kidney Bank. And this is one of those extraordinarily unfortunate things. And you're right, Miles. They get more and more outrageous with each story. They get progressively crazy. But we should also be progressively unsurprised, because this is what it is. And this has always been what it is in every aspect of medical business.
You know, I love when in my brain, our conversations that we're having cross with like Black poets. So I wanted to read like a very short part of Nikki Giovanni's Crutches. She says, women are supposed to be strong, so they develop social smiles and secret drinking problems in female lovers whom they never touch except in dreams. Men are supposed to be strong, so they have heart attacks and develop other women who don't know their weaknesses and hide their fears behind male lovers who they religiously touch each Saturday morning on the basketball court. I think about that. That was, she wrote that in the 70s. It's in the Cotton Candy on a Rainy Day poetry book. And I think about how that critique of both the social parameters of men and women, but also the medical results of it in one stanza. Nikki Giovanni gives like a whole essay worth of critique around how just our gender socializations end up making our medical realities. So I just want to offer that as well, because it felt apt to this conversation.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Bring us some light, Miles.
So, my life was changed. I'll never be the same. Because over this weekend, or actually it was last week, it was on Wednesday, I got to see Cats, the Jellicle Ball. If you have not heard, Cats has been reimagined to be this ballroom, queer extravaganza at the PAC New York City Theater. They took T.S. Eliot's framing of things and this introduction of Cats and used it as ballroom characters. And it was so, so, so cool, interesting. It's been a minute. I've seen a lot of theater because I'm a cultured person who goes see a lot of theater. When I tell you the interaction, the electricity that was in the room, I've just not experienced that in New York City theater. There's a woman named Temperance who's like huge in the ballroom scene. She's just amazing. I love her. And she plays Griselda, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, in Cats. And she has the big like memory song, and she's kind of the shabby cat who's older, and she steals the show. And it really gets me excited to know that there are spaces inside of theater and inside of film. I'm saying that reluctantly because they're harder and harder to find, because it feels like films are getting worse and worse. But there are these spaces inside of specifically theater that are willing to reimagine things for a Black queer audience, or with Black queer content in the center of it, and re-give it to a mainstream audience. I think also, without naming anything that I've also seen that I might have even enjoyed any other theater pieces, I think my favorite thing was that this was so much fun. It was so much fun. I feel like anytime I've seen Black queer or queerness or Blackness explored in theater, it has been mostly around some type of traumatic event or some type of self-deprecating perspective that we have to get over or overcome, or the main character has to overcome. I was so excited to see so many queer people just celebrate themselves and be in joy. And the last thing that I'll say about this, if it's to entice people to want to go see it, is that Cats is pretty much known and made fun of for its campiness and its kitsch. Ballroom so celebrates that. So Ballroom and Cats marrying each other and seeing each other and coming together feels so, 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 so right. It really feels like a crescendo of Ballroom, that this thing that is so founded on camp, so founded on extravagance, has met like Cats, which is like American pop culture kitsch and camp and extravagance at its height. I hope that it gets on Broadway. I hope that more people go and see it and support it. And I hope that, as I hope for all things that are Black and queer that end up in the theater, this only opens the pathways of people who are of marginalized identities who still want to be able to participate in things like theater without sacrificing their story, their sense of humors, without having to sacrifice senses of self in order to create their own stories. I lied. The last thing I'll say, which is just an antidote, is that y'all know I'm a little woo-woo. I thought, so in the queer community, specifically in the trans community, it's very common, specifically back in the day, like if you are a doll, a trans woman, you will put TS in front of your name, right? So we know like TS Madison, because that would stand for transsexual Madison. So that's like very common. So I thought it was kind of funny that this story was T.S. Eliot's. Because to me, it was almost like this was meant to happen. I was like, Cats was meant to be this queer, fabulous explosion of color and dance and song. And something about that, those names in that tradition connecting each other in the author's names is like really tickled me to think that there is some kind of cosmic power in the sky that said, oh, wait until however many decades later, they're really going to fall out in 2024 when we reinvent this. Yeah, have y'all seen it? Are y'all going to go see it?
I'm going to see it. I've heard everyone that I've talked to that's gone has been like, it's so much fun. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, the people that have gone and didn't ask me to go with them. But that's okay, Miles. I will. It's okay. You'll make up for it by going with me to see something that I want to see. But I think the fun part of it is, one, we just need some fun and some joy right now. But I find that everyone gets so uncomfortable with fun on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And so when Fat Ham was on Broadway and there's the end where it's just this beautiful sort of expression where you literally get out of your seat. There's like lights, there's confetti, there's all of this. And people were like, what do we do? Get involved, everybody. It's a little call and response. Stand up, clap, do your thing. And I think the same thing, that's why everyone loved Pearly Victorious, because there was such like a, they were giving to you and you were giving back. So I guess so much a part of that is just like Black theater tradition. And I can't talk about theater or Black theater without talking about National Black Theater, obviously. Shout out to Sade and Jonathan. But I do want to see this because I feel like it's how I like to see the theater, which is also how I like to go to concerts and like to be in church. I like to get up and clap my hands and hoot and holler.
And they do, and they're doing cabaret seating too. So like, depending on where you sit, you sit and they're standing with you. So you feel like you're in the ballroom. The judges change.
Stop.
Yeah, so I just want to add that too.
Okay, I'm going to look for tickets.
I got a lot here, Brother Miles, but I'm going to let you go, DeRay. Sibling Miles, excuse me. I got a lot here, but I'm going to let you go, Brother DeRay. Go ahead, man.
You know, I'm excited to see it. I also look back and I think about, Miles, you said on the last episode, but how quickly things become famous in this country. Like, we just have a machine around fame. Not that things last, but things can become famous very quickly. I am heartened to see that Pose not only had a moment, but really did invite so many people into ballroom in a way that lasted. I think about Legendary. I think about, like, ballroom went from being a thing that it's like, if you know, you know. And if you know somebody, you know somebody. I remember when I went to my first ball, I'm like, who, this is late? I'm like, the ball don't start till 1 o'clock on Monday. I'm like,
oh, I thought you were saying late as in, late in the queer community also means tacky.
I meant like, literally,
didn't start till 2 a.m.
I show up at 11 a.m. I was like, 11 p.m. I'm like, okay, cool. Why was I there at 11? Because when that happened at 11? I was like, ooh, this is, I got to take off work if I'm going to go to this. But I think about how it's sort of wild to me because I feel like I blinked and ballroom was almost so mainstream that I'm like, you're exploiting it now. I'm like, I don't even know if you like gay people or trans people, but y'all got a ballroom scene all of a sudden. And it is a testament to all of the people who participated in Pose, I'd say, who were fans of it, who allowed it to come back and to see a Broadway show and you know, yeah. So I think about Dahlon, just so many people in the production who made that show possible and who took a bet on it before ballroom was a cultural moment. And obviously Beyonce, but like, she to me is just one of the pinnacles of like, wow, this is like a TV show that invited people in a moment and became a thing. And now we see the manifestations of that all over the place. So I'm excited to see this on Broadway.
Look, I love Blackness and I love Black queerness, and I am a huge fan, probably as big a fan as a cishet male Black man has ever been, your culture and your community. I think about the beginning, well, not even the beginning, but I think about the Jay-Z video from the album 444 Moonlight, in which you see these brilliant Black comedians, Jerrod Carmichael, who has since come out, and so many other, Tiffany Haddish, all these others, performing as the members of the cast of Friends. And at the beginning, you see that iconic intro, I'll be there for you. They're dancing at the Central Park fountain in New York. And then they probably do like two or three scenes of what would effectively be a Friends episode. And it even probably was a legitimate Friends script. And then about 90 seconds in, you realize, oh, shit, this is cool that they're Black, but Friends ain't funny. Fuck Friends. right? So when I was reading your article, I'm going to land this plane. I love all the black queerness and brilliance, but I don't need that built on the chassis of Cats, which I frankly think wasn't shit. You know what I mean? I'm not moved by Cats. I am moved by I Love You, Porgy. I don't care about Cats. I do care about August Wilson and the Century series. I cried tears of joy at Pearly Victorious, and then I took my mom and her best friend to see it because I think it was that important, right, to preserve the language. So I love Legendary. I enjoyed Pose, but I want to see black queer brilliance built organically on a black chassis. I don't think it needs to come from Cats. If you remember a few years ago, there was a film, Cats, with James Corden, that was unbearable to watch.
You need the right strand of weed. It's bearable. I laughed.
You come visit DC and bring that good. Okay. I'll screen some of mine. But I just don't believe in whiteness as the underpinning for anything, particularly as the underpinning for the brilliance of these people, these amazing athletes that you see in Legendary and in Ballroom and in Pose. I would love to go see a ballroom show live. I just don't want to intrude, which is my conclusion here, that I almost feel uncomfortable saying what this community should build its creativity upon, because it's probably not my place to opine. But I just want to say I have full support and will dedicate myself and my time and resources to watering the creativity and the freeness and the fullness of that black queer community, because you've given us all so much joy over the years, whether or not we know it, and even removed from the context of human sexuality.
Yeah. And just to respond to what you were saying, so I totally agree with you. Usually that's my whole kick. Shebang. I always feel like I have a Toni Morrison angel on my shoulder. That's like that white gaze.
Yeah.
So what I will say about
G-A-Z-E. G-A-Z-E, by the way. Right. Yeah.
But what I will say about this particular piece, and I hope that it does get even more developed, but what I will say is that Ballroom is about making fun of performance. It's about making fun of things. It's about saying, look how silly this outside, above ground world is, and look how easy it is to pretend to be them and be better at it, which is why things like realness are such a like big deal of it. So I do think there was something it just scratched a part of my brain to see this ballroom culture that's all about making fun of performance, make fun of something that is the make fun of the most American made fun of performance. There was something really interesting about that. But I hear what you're saying about like this being a black queer thing and it needs like a white thing to get through. But every step of the way, what I will say, what was perfect for me is every step of the way, it felt like it was making fun of that. And felt like it was just totally taking the P word out of Cats. So I would say if you go in with the mind of like satire, it wouldn't be this thing that is like be turning into like black queerness, like it's turning black queerness. There's not this black queer thing riding on whiteness when you finally get to see it. But I had the same type of, child, why do we need to be talking about this? In talking or talking or reinventing Cats, but it's done really clever, and I think your mind might change up once you see it. Before we close this segment, I just want to shout out the directors who I'm hoping I'm saying their names right, Zillion Levingston. I hope that's how you pronounce it, and Bill Roche. Those are the directors of the Cats the Cats and Angelica Ball that I saw. I didn't say that during my first news intro.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, D.R. Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson. It's an election year, and predictably, immigration is in the news, often framed by the word crisis. But where are the more nuanced, human-centered stories of migration? Enter Movement with Muklit Hadiro. Muklit is an Ethiopian refugee and world-renowned musician who has created a show to uplift the songs and stories of immigrant musicians, shining a light on the cultural power blooming from communities with roots across borders. Muklit calls it, quote, bumping the soundtrack to a radically diverse world. After this episode, I encourage you to like, subscribe, and follow Movement with Muklit Hadiro wherever you get your podcasts, or check out movementstories.com.